Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. An estimated one out of every five Americans has been diagnosed with one or more psychological or physical disabilities. That makes disabled Americans one of our largest minorities. And yet, most of our history books pay little notice to the specific role that disability has played in our nation's past. Today on the program, we discuss the contributions of the disabled to our laws, policies, economics, popular culture, and collective identity. And along the way, we will consider just what disability means in America today. Our guest, Dr. Kim Nielsen, a professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo and the author of four books, including a pair on Helen Keller. Her latest book is A Disability History of the United States. Kim Nielsen, welcome to Focus. Glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
And as we begin our conversation, we welcome your questions and comments as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach out to us on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You describe your book, Kim, as a wide-ranging chronological American history narrative told through the lives of people with disabilities. How is America's historical narrative different when told through those lives?
Oh, I think it's different because we see different people. We focus on different things. I think the debate about what it means to be a good American and whose bodies are considered to be good citizens is really at the core.
How can we better understand our history through disability and our attitudes and policies towards it?
Well, I think that we look at American ideals when we think about disability. You know, one of our great American ideals is of independence, and often we consider people with disabilities to be completely dependent. So I think that by looking at disability, we can rethink those ideals, think about how we define them and who's included.
In fact, there is sort of that narrative in our history that's something that people tend to equate as an American trait or ideal, and that's sort of rugged individualism. How do we square that concept with the reality that you note in your book that sort of dependency is, in fact, at the heart of, as you say, both the human and the American experience?
It is. You know, as Americans, we depend on each other to vote and to vote wisely, and we depend on each other to contribute to society in all kinds of ways. I use roads that other people help to pay for and those kinds of things. So we're really deeply dependent on one another. And yet, you know, we as a country often talk about rugged individualism, and I can do it myself. And that's a real contradiction in U.S. history. But I think thinking about disability forces us to think about how we're all dependent in various ways on each other.
So let's talk about the term disability. How do we define it in America today?
Oh, today I think we're fighting over how to define it. But historically it's tended to be defined as a medical condition. But I think today and at other points in time in other cultures, it's clear that disability can sometimes be about bodily differences, cognitive differences, but it's also very much socially defined and defined by how we build spaces and defined by who we include, defined by what we think to be pretty, what we think to be handsome, what we think to be smart.
I guess if we want to understand America's relationship and history with disability, we should probably start with those cultures and people that were indigenous to North America long before America showed up. What do we know about disability among people who lived in North America before Christopher Columbus, before subsequent generations of Europeans landed on the Atlantic shore?
Well, we know that prior to the arrival of Europeans, amongst the indigenous peoples here, there were all kinds of physical differences, cognitive differences, psychological differences, just as there are today, but that they defined disability very differently. They defined it more in relational terms, that those people who were not tied into the community were those who were considered to be disabled. So disability didn't depend on what your body could do or couldn't do or what your mind did or how it worked, but depended upon your lack of relationships to society.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. You know, if I were an individual who did not speak out loud, as long as I could contribute to society in another way, whether that was carrying water or weaving a basket that didn't leak, you know, which would be a marvelous thing, I would be considered an important and contributing member to society, regardless of my lack of speech. But the person who didn't contribute would be the person considered disabled.
And would you say that's sort of that applies to Native Americans for centuries, or were there other examples, other things that you would point to?
I think it did apply for centuries, but, you know, certainly I'm always floored when I think about how among indigenous peoples there was an estimated almost 2,500 languages prior to European arrival, so there's lots of different cultures there. They also had what I think is really fascinating, what was called a Great Plains Sign Language, that throughout much of North America, indigenous peoples communicated in a signed language. And though they spoke different verbal languages, they communicated in a common signed language that Europeans discovered when they arrived here.
Well, and that is interesting because, you know, we think of, in America today, we might think of the deaf community as part of the disabled community. But you're pointing out that communication, it all depends on kind of what is the need of the community at large.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, that's a point of contention within the deaf community today. But certainly people who are deaf are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act and the other civil rights legislation that we have today.
So what role did disability play in the shaping of the U.S. in the 1700s? Certainly as colonies arrived, and what were the attitudes then?
Well, originally people with disabilities were highly discouraged from taking the trip to North America because of concerns about how they would fare in the communities that landed. But at the same time, the people arrived who had, you know, bodies that worked all kinds of different ways. People with disabilities were very much integrated into the communities and worked in the communities in whatever ways they could and did and enjoyed, just like everyone else. Communities tended to support people with disabilities just as they did children, those who needed assistance at different times.
Who were some of the key figures associated with disability in the colonial era, then in the Revolutionary War era, that we should pay heed to?
You know, Cotton Mather, the preacher and theologian, was someone who stuttered significantly, and he wrote and thought about disability in different ways. He tended to consider it as a religious affliction, a sign of his sin. Hmm. You know, certainly we know amongst fur traders and farmers, disability was simply a part of what happened when you were a fur trader. Body parts froze. You know, you might trap a finger in a fur trap. It was simply a routine part of life, that everybody's bodies were shaped and marked in different ways. And then certainly amongst the Revolutionary War, you know, that was a point at which the nation began to think really seriously about disability public policy.
Well, I couldn't help but wonder if war itself, just by virtue of you have soldiers who lose limbs and then eventually they find themselves into civilian political life, that there are some folks, maybe not among the founders, but maybe the subsequent generation, who had suffered disabilities or found themselves without limbs or found themselves witnessing others that had, and whether that affected attitudes at all.
I think it very much did, although one of the things that's really interesting to me is we found that amongst revolutionary soldiers who were disabled, after the war, they married at the same rates as non-disabled soldiers. They were employed at the same rates. They did the same types of jobs as non-disabled soldiers. And I think that shows a real integration and acceptance and an assumption that disability was a routine part of life after the Revolutionary War.
You mentioned Cotton Mather. Are there others? And that's a name I think we, like a lot of people, kind of know the name but don't know much about him.
Yeah, he was one of the major religious figures in the colonial period and, you know, very interested in integrating religion into U.S. contemporary life at that time. But, he thought about disability because of his lifelong stutter and wrote about it and, you know, considered what it meant for him. And it was something he struggled with because he is interpreted as a sign of a lack of faith on his part.
Were there some others of his generation or subsequent generations that we should know more about that maybe we don't?
You know, we know that, for example, Thomas Jefferson had a sister with cognitive disabilities who lived in his home and worked in the home and was very active with his family for most of her life. You know, I think it was such a routine part of life that they were simply there.
Does it surprise you that was sort of the prevailing attitude of that era, that it was just, well, this is just matter of fact, this is the way the world is?
I think in some respects it does, but it also was, life was sometimes physically hard in the
right.
colonial period
sure.
and the early American period, and, it was the way it was.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Kim Nielsen, professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo and the author of A Disability History of the United States. We welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or, as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Today we think of the impact the Americans with Disabilities Act has had on accessibility for people with disabilities, but I'm sure that was not the first law impacted by or in some way addressing disability in the United States.
Oh, no, not at all. We could go all the way back to prior to the creation of the United States. Immigration law has often served to keep people with disabilities out of the United States.
How so?
Well, if you had what immigration officials considered a disability they could read on your body with cognitive disabilities or a physical impairment or blindness or deafness, that could be a reason for excluding you at the nation's gates. So I think the first disability restrictive immigration laws were passed in the 1600s and continued to well into the 20th century.
And that's essentially at the heart of it was the idea of only bringing people into the U.S. who were, at least according to the concepts of the time, able-bodied, that would contribute in a more effective way. Is that the concept?
That tended to be it. It was called a likely to become a public charge clause. So if immigration officials believed that you were likely to become a public charge, they could exclude you. But we see... there's over and over again examples. I talk about one in my book, a man from the early 20th century who was deaf, who came with, I think it's 3 written job offers. He was apparently a very good blacksmith. And he had 3 written job offers in his hand and family who were willing to support him. But despite that, immigration officials considered him, because he was deaf, to be unemployable and sent him back once he reached Ellis Island. So often, despite reality, there was an assumption that people with disabilities would always be dependent, and that was reason enough to exclude them from the United States.
Now, once someone was in the U.S., though, how were those within the community that had some sort of disability, how were they treated? Were they seen as full citizens?
If they were citizens, they were technically legally full citizens. But we know that employment discrimination has existed, education discrimination. Even public schools were not required to educate anyone with a disability until the early 1970s. They could just simply say no and exclude people. So often people were excluded from public education because of physical or cognitive disabilities. Like I said, employment discrimination, often housing difficulties, particularly those with mobility disabilities.
How was disability dealt with socially in America, for good or bad, through the Civil War era, Reconstruction, the Industrial Age, and beyond?
Well, it somewhat mattered upon class. Obviously, always having money helps, and it's helped throughout history. So for people of greater money background, it was in some ways socially easier, but often people with disabilities have tended to be segregated, isolated, less integration into public life in all ways.
So what are some of your favorite stories that you have examined, individuals through U.S. history that have suffered from, you know, have dealt with some sort of disability.
Yeah.
Who stands out to you?
You know, I have a couple favorites. One is a guy named Charles Johnson, who was a Civil War soldier who was disabled in the war and then placed in charge of what was called the Invalid Corps. And this was a group of Civil War soldiers, all disabled, who were kept in the military and given what the military considered easy jobs to allow able-bodied soldiers to fight. But under Charles Johnson, the Invalid Corps was actually engaged in a pretty vicious battle. And he and his soldiers, though very outnumbered, successfully got the Confederates out of the way. And he always made a joke about how his Invalid Corps soldiers didn't run because they couldn't run. He wrote marvelous letters to his wife that people can read today. I also fell in love with a woman named Julia O'Brien, who was an English teacher in the United States for a good 20 years. And she'd had polio as a kid, and so could not walk. And when World War II tire rationing came, that meant that she could not get new tires and could not get to work and was faced with the likelihood of losing her job simply because she couldn't get new tires. And she wrote a long series of letters to Franklin Roosevelt asking for exemptions to the tire rationing policy.
And what was his response to that?
You know, as far as I can tell, she was not successful. There were actually hundreds of people who wrote FDR and the federal government during World War II because of the tire and gasoline rationing. And these were people with disabilities, tended to be mobility disabilities, who could not walk, but who had full-time jobs and feared losing their jobs because of the rationing during the war and being unable to support their families.
Of course, the you know, sort of the obvious question is, you would think FDR, what we know, of course, is that he had suffered from polio as a child, that he was, you know, used a wheelchair.
Yes.
So if ever there was someone who would have sympathy about that and would want, you would think, to do something about it, it would be him.
Yes, you would think that. And the people who wrote to him said that as well, very explicitly.
We do have this perception, though, that, you know, if you look at history books, that for the most part, the public was generally not aware of FDR being in a wheelchair, you know, that he was so often photographed not in one.
Yeah. And historians argue about this. I think that a good chunk of Americans were unaware of that. You know, at the same time, there were lots of Americans who knew. Anybody who'd gone to D.C. knew that there were ramps all over D.C. during FDR's presidency. And it's clear that wheelchair users themselves wrote to FDR and clearly knew he was a chair user. They would send him pictures of their own chairs or suggestions about adaptive equipment or designs on their own wheelchair. They knew. They knew how to read his body and knew how to read what was going on.
What do you perceive was his attitude about it? Do you think this was something that he didn't want the world to know about, or what were his attitudes towards this notion of disability?
Yeah. It's actually one of these things I change my mind about almost every day. But, you know, I think FDR was pragmatic in this regard. I don't think he was someone who was ashamed of his disability. He was a politician who worked hard to get accomplished what he wanted to, and he felt that people, the majority, would not vote for him if they knew he was a chair user, that people had what we might call ableist ideas about what a good leader is, and assumed at that time that a good leader couldn't be a wheelchair user. And I suspect he was probably right. You know, sadly, we also know, however, that when he visited newly disabled soldiers was one of the few times he would use his chair. So he, you know, he was willing to do so when he felt it was important.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing U.S. history through the prism of disability with Dr. Kim Nielsen, professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo. She's the author of A Disability History of the United States. We welcome your questions and comments for our guest at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Why do you feel we need a disability history of the United States?
Well, one, I think it's simply important to know that people with disabilities have always been present and played a very important role. I also think it's important to look at how disability has always been in our discussions of education and in our discussions of social welfare policy, in our discussions of who can vote. It goes on and on. So it's there, and I think we should recognize it. And it's helped to shape society, just as race, sex, gender have all helped to shape society.
So then what were some of the major highlights in the development of education and rights associated with disability in the 20th century, certainly?
Yeah, I think the what's called IDEA, they keep changing the acronym, but the law passed, I think, in 1973 that guaranteed access to public education for children with disabilities is absolutely pivotal because education helps with employment, it helps everything else, and if people can't access education, there are consequences. So that's been really important. Section 504 of the Rehab Act of 1977 guaranteed or stated that organizations, buildings receiving public funds should not discriminate on the basis of disability. That's been important. And then certainly the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, passed in 1990, is incredibly important because it states that people with disabilities should not be discriminated against in any way.
Were there other steps along the way prior to the 1970s and certainly prior to the ADA in 1990? I'm thinking back also to the 1960s and the civil rights era itself and what impact that would ultimately have on the development of some of these rights for the disabled.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the 1950s, when people began to talk about civil rights legislation, disability was actually talked about at that point in time as something that should be included. It wasn't ultimately, but it was definitely there in the conversations. And disability rights activists were very much involved in the racial freedom movements and the women's movement as well.
We're talking with Dr. Kim Nielsen, professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo and the author of A Disability History of the United States. To join our conversation, you can call us right now at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, and we will take some of your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus.
As 2012 draws to a close, please take a moment to think of how much you've listened and relied on the programming from WILL. Then make your contribution today. Your gift will be tax deductible, and it allows us to invest in the outstanding programs you listen to every day. You can help us reach the goal of raising $1 million by December 31st when you donate online at willpledge.org. On behalf of all the listeners of WILL, thank you for your support.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Dr. Kim Nielsen, professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo and the author of A Disability History of the United States. And we are, of course, talking about disability in the U.S. and the role of those disabled Americans in U.S. history and looking at U.S. history a little bit differently through that prism. And we welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions and comments on our Facebook page. We're at Will Radio TV Online, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And we'll begin this morning with Susan in Urbana. Susan, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks very much. I regret to say that I missed the introductory part of the program, but I was very pleased to hear the legislation and so forth that was just recounted that has changed things, and I wanted to put in a pitch for the, Tim Nugent and the University of Illinois, and I didn't know whether our author was aware that the U of I was a leader in getting a lot of that made into law, and that we have, I think, really Tim Nugent to thank for the cuts in sidewalks, not only in Urbana-Champaign, but all over the USA.
So, Susan, I'm so glad you called, because I know that the University of Illinois system and Tim Nugent are incredibly important, and I think, you know, as you've said, they began far before many of these laws were passed, I think as early as 1948.
And you were mentioning education, and I came to teach at the U of I in 1962, and I was very interested that our overseas students, were the ones I was working with on their English, had accessibility, and the wonderful anecdote about a fellow who was in a wheelchair who was stuck in the snow, and a fellow came along who was blind and gave him a shove, got him out of the, I don't know quite how the story went, maybe somebody else will call in and fill in the details, but it was one quote-unquote at that time disabled person pushing another out of a snowdrift, and it was just kind of local lore back in the 50s.
Oh, that's a marvelous example.
Yeah. So anyway, we've been privileged to be a leader with accessible. I used to take the international students who came to the campus and were in our English classes on field trips over to the model apartment where counters were lower so that wheelchair folks could manage in the kitchen, and we just have been a wonderfully privileged community to have basketball, wheelchair basketball. It's now international and whatnot, but we started it here. So I just wanted to put in a pitch for the big U.
Well, thank you. Yes, I understand that you know, wheelchair sports owe a lot to the University of Illinois and Illinois itself.
Yep. So you're over there in Toledo. Come on over sometime.
Well, thank you.
If you can, we'd love to have you come.
Thank you.
Thank you for your book. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Susan. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I think I should also point out the Division of Disability Resources and Educational Services at the College of Applied Health Sciences at the U of I has a nice history of disability services at the U of I online, and we will we'll add that link to today's post on our website.
Oh, marvelous.
How did you come to be interested in disability history?
Yeah, purely by accident. I am trained in women in politics, actually, and started looking at Helen Keller as a political figure. And I knew nothing about her and was floored to find out that she was a hugely political figure. So I started with Helen Keller, looking at her from a political framework, and found disability history to be incredibly fun and interesting, really the most interesting thing I've ever done. So here I am.
I imagine a lot of our listeners are familiar with Helen Keller if they are through, you know, the Miracle Worker, that story, and maybe have a little bit of a sense of her biography. But tell us a little bit about her, and in particular, you know, after talking about sort of biographically about her life, what about her political life drew you to her?
Sure. Keller lived for 88 years, a really long time, and was born in the post-Civil War South, but ended up going to Radcliffe College, the premier female college. She was someone who had become deaf and blind at a very young age, but someone who was curious and ended up loving to read and loving to learn. And she became an incredible advocate for people with disabilities and traveled all over the globe, often on behalf of the State Department, as well as the American Federation for the Blind. I was really interested in her because she had, well, she was in her 20s, become a socialist. She was a founding member of the ACLU. She was a female suffragist. She was a labor activist, but I hadn't known any of that. And I was fascinated by how, you know, in the early 20th century, when lots of people said that women as a whole were unfit for politics and their bodies couldn't stand it, that, you know, Helen Keller, whose body was very different and had significant impairments, went into the political sphere and just embraced it.
And just to clarify, what I recall is that she was blind, she couldn't hear, and she couldn't speak, right?
That's true. She did go through some oral training as an adult, could speak. Not everyone could understand her, but certainly people who were around her a lot could.
I guess, and I do remember, I mean, I, you know, read about her growing up and was equally impressed and fascinated with the aggressiveness with which she, you know, communicated with the world and wrote a great deal. Is that what sort of caught you and got you interested in her specifically?
You know, actually, what really captivated me is she wanted to support Robert La Follette, the good Wisconsin guy, in the 1924 presidential election, but ended up writing him a letter saying that she was going to keep her opinions quiet because people opposed to her political ideas would say, oh, look how mean La Follette is. He's misleading and abusing poor Helen Keller because deaf and blind, she could never have her own opinions. And that angered her a lot. But it was strong enough to actually keep her quiet during that election. And I was really struck by that, you know, for this really smart, interesting, amazing writer, people could attempt to silence her in that way. So I became fascinated by her.
You know, and that kind of gets at a larger point about history in general and how we tend to look back at people and communities and events. Do you think one of the reasons you wanted to explore a disability history of the United States was to sort of say you can't put people in a category based strictly on these particular characteristics about them, that they are fully formed personalities and people with depth and different attitudes and ideas, and so you can't just sort of put them in a container and say, oh, well, this is our collection of disabled Americans versus this is our collection of this group or that group. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. One of the things that I learned and I'm learning and I'm continuing to learn is that, you know, people with disabilities are just as varied as people without disabilities and, come from different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, different political ideologies, some of them like little dogs, some of them like big dogs, some like cats. You know, it's just as varied as the rest of the human population. And I think we've tended to dismiss people with disabilities as being inadequate and unable to participate. And that's clearly not the case.
Earlier you talked about Charles Johnson, you talked about Julia O'Brien and Helen Keller, of course, just a couple of minutes ago. Who are some other figures from U.S. history that maybe have gotten short shrift because they were disabled?
One guy who always has fascinated me is a man named Charles Steinmetz, who was a very short-statured man. He was a Jewish man who'd immigrated to the U.S. in 1889, and it's sort of unclear how he came through immigration, but he was initially turned away. He became one of the world's famous engineers and worked for General Electric, an electrical car pioneer in the 20th century, and clearly a very favored philanthropist in New York State, upper New York State. And I'm fascinated by him simply because he was so important in technology in the United States, and yet almost got turned away at the border. And his disability mattered to him, but just as science mattered to him. And what I like about him, too, is that apparently he made a very good meatloaf. and I love that fact because it just shows all the various facets of human beingness, right?
You mentioned earlier, and you mentioned in your book, that U.S. disability history is complicated, but you also say it's a contradictory story. What do you mean by that? What's the contradiction?
Well, I think it's at some points it's a contradiction because of the way that we wrestle with ideals of independence in our country. People with disabilities often deal with the stereotype that they can't be independent. Yet I try and argue in the book that none of us are independent at a real core. I think that's a contradiction.
Are there others?
I think in some respects, people with disabilities force us to also, you know, think again about the really multifaceted nature of society, that all of us have a whole variety of identities that are important to us. I've been thinking of Daniel Inouye, the U.S. senator who just died yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, he was someone who was disabled after World War II and, you know, has been an amazing individual in U.S. history and very important. And how lucky we are that, you know, he has stayed around to contribute and was not completely isolated and disregarded after the war.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Dr. Kim Nielsen about U.S. history as seen through the prism of disability. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL.
Hey, Craig, one of the other stories I've really been fascinated with in the book is of a young woman in Minneapolis-St. Paul who'd been very active in the disability rights movement in the 60s and 70s, who was quadriplegic. She was raped in her apartment in the 1970s, and Minnesota law, like many laws, state laws at that point in time, required proof of physical resistance to prosecute rape. And because she had not physically resisted as a quadriplegic, though the police were able to catch the man, they were not able to prosecute him, which it just floored me when I learned this. And what amazed me about her is that she went on then to say, okay, we need to learn a lot more about people with disabilities and sexual assault. And she garnered incredible alliances between social service agencies, the disability rights movement, the feminist movement, the police officers, the prosecuting attorney, and they were able to reform laws in Minnesota, but also expand sexual assault services to women with disabilities, and that became really important.
We talked about the Americans with Disabilities Act, but I want to take a couple more minutes to talk through. Did that passage of that act change not just our national conversation about disability, but our attitude towards it, you think?
I think it did, and I think it still is. It's not something that happened overnight. You know, but prior to that, if a person with a disability was encountering discrimination in employment or housing or education, you know, it was they could seek help, but it was simply considered as a charity thing, right? A charity issue. And now it's become an issue of rights, and that's a very different framework. And I think that's changed how we think about disability, and particularly for younger people coming up with disabilities, they think about this as an issue of rights, discrimination, as a civil issue, and not simply as a charity issue.
You note in your book that after you began undertaking this project, this book, you found a new sense of perspective about the world of disability through your daughter. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think like all scholars, you know, we think we know what we're doing and we know everything, and that's what I did. And after I'd been in the field over 10 years and after I'd started this book, my daughter, who was then 16, became disabled and is now a part-time wheelchair user and has other things that she deals with as well. And it was a reminder to me that while I've talked about and written about, and you know, you say that in the introduction that 20% of U.S. people have a disability, I had said and knew that it was a fluid category, that all of us could go in and out of it, but somehow I thought that meant other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it really brought it home that that is everybody, and that could happen to me. I also learned a lot about the what some people call the relational nature of disability. You know, how all of us who live and work with people with disabilities are impacted by that. It's very relational. I also learned that, you know, being a disabled person does not mean you're miserable.
Right.
Right? You know, just as, I don't know, living in Toledo doesn't mean I'm incredibly happy, even though, of course, Toledo's a wonderful place, you know.
Right.
That it's more complex than that. And that happiness is far more variable and depends on a whole bunch of other things, and that people with disabilities, you know, do live very full lives. I've learned that we can have a lot of fun. I've learned that taking risks and doing bold things can be incredibly fun.
I imagine also you've gained some sense of perspective that any of us have once we know someone in our lives who maybe is in a wheelchair, and you know, you look at a flight of stairs differently. You think about where you're going differently.
I do, yes. I look at flights of stairs. I look at airports. I look at malls. I look at cabs differently. You know, all of those things, it changes how one moves through the world. And I even, you know, I look at the demands on my students and of people in employment very differently.
I mean, I was even thinking about this last spring when I moved to a new apartment complex and realized that I had a third floor walk up. And I was thinking to myself, well, that's fine for me, but I do have a couple of friends that, you know, are in wheelchairs. I thought, well, I'm never inviting them over, or I've got, you know, a real battle on my head. I got to figure out a way to get them up into this apartment.
Absolutely. And then that shapes, you know, your entire social life. And I assume it also has an impact on you, right, when you're carrying lots of groceries.
Oh, well,
right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's really delights, I think, disability scholars is how much adaptive equipment has now become used for other purposes.
Yeah, well, that's true. You see that in grocery stores, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And even, you know, touch pads are things that started out as adaptive equipment. I remember laughing the last time I was pregnant that near the end of my pregnancy, the only bathroom I could get into and shut the door was the wheelchair-accessible bathroom stall that was bigger, you know, because in the others, my tummy just didn't fit. You know, that there are ways that all of us benefit from this adaptive equipment.
What are some things that people who are not disabled do not understand about disability in all its forms, even today?
Right. I think the biggest one, at least from my perspective today, is that people with disability don't live miserable lives. I think there's still an assumption that disability is an inherent tragedy, that it's miserable and one's life is then ruined. And that's simply not true. It's, you know, instead, it's the discrimination that makes life more difficult, and it's the isolation that results from ableist attitudes that can make life difficult. I think that's a common misconception. I think a common misconception is that it's others. I think it's all of us that wrestle with and deal with disability. I think there's an assumption that people with disabilities are not around, but instead, people with disabilities are always here. Many disabilities are not apparent. And so we, you know, us, them, they are always here.
Earlier in the show, I asked you how we define disability in America today. How would you seek to define disability in America differently from how it is defined today?
Oh, well, I'm answering you as a historian. but I've been thinking about disability as there are always differences. And disability historically has tended to be considered the physical or cognitive differences that are stigmatized. And which are stigmatized changes a lot over time. You know, right now I think the legal definition works actually pretty well. And the ADA recognizes the social definition of disability in that it's created by social, physical, legal barriers, and that the role of the law is to eliminate those barriers.
Okay, crystal ball time. If you do a volume two of this book,
right,
30 years from now, what will the next 30 years of U.S. history reveal about our attitudes, our laws, our society regarding disability?
I think that the rights of people with disabilities will continue to be recognized and expanded. I think that economic differences are going to be more and more visible.
In what ways?
We know that people who live in poverty have higher disability rates. People with limited access to health insurance have higher disability rates. And often then don't have greater access to education, employment. And so the economic differences between people with disabilities are going to be clearer and clearer, and people with disabilities with economic resources are increasingly integrated into society and succeeding economically and socially and politically. Those without cash, I think, are going to be more and more isolated. That's a depressing perspective.
Yeah. Is it a correlative relationship, or do you think there's some vague level of causation that
you know, there actually, you know, is some causation in terms of people in poverty tend to live closer to areas of pollution. Pollution often causes disability. People in poverty are often employed in physically dangerous jobs. Those often cause disability. So there's some causation there, definitely. I think we're also going to explore as a nation the international perspectives on disability. You know, the U.S. Senate just voted no on endorsing the United Nations Treaty on the Rights of People with Disabilities internationally. And I think that's going to become a bigger issue.
I wanted to ask you about that. Did that vote surprise you?
It disappointed me. It disappointed me a lot. You know, the treaty is very much in line with the ADA, and in some ways is based on the ADA, and so this is simply a mirror of what U.S. law is. And I was very disappointed in the U.S. Senate.
What role do you think people with disabilities can play in the coming generations, maybe that might affect a different approach or different thought, you know, when it comes to that next vote down the road?
I think people with disabilities will and are becoming increasingly integrated into political life, social life, economic life, and that's going to have an impact on the Senate. I think it will. In some ways I'm optimistic for the next 30, 40 years in that regard.
You wind up your book with a little epilogue talking about an experience you had when you were about 4 or 5 years old. Tell us a little bit about that, just briefly, and what it has to do with the book itself.
Yeah, as a kid, I went through speech therapy, and we were living in rural Montana at that point in time, in which there were very few social services, and my parents drove me, I don't know, 40, 50 miles to the Easter-Sills facility. And I always knew that I had gone through speech rehab, but I'd never thought much about it until I was in the field for many, many years, and it dawned on me that, oh my gosh, I was an Easter-Sills kid. You know, that this was flirting in and out of disability. And how I experienced that as a kid as a really marvelous moment, actually, in my life. And not because I, quote, conquered my speech impediment or anything like that, but because it was a fun time for me. They made it a very fun space. And I think that's what most of us need, right? We need spaces as people to explore our bodies and our voices. And that's important. But it also reminded me how much all of us go in and out of that category of disability. It's a very fluid thing that affects all of us.
And I guess that also reinforces this idea that the historical definition of disability maybe has been broadened.
Oh, absolutely. I just got bifocals, so I've been thinking about this a lot. you know, that the fact that I have glasses, I can continue to be a teacher and to drive my car. But certainly, you know, 200-300 years ago, that would have had significant consequence because I wouldn't have had access to that. I, you know, would have had a significant visual impairment.
You would have had a hard time finding a car, too.
I would have, yes. I would have driven my horse into a tree or something. You know, it changes over time.
What else should we think about in the coming decades, in the coming generations, when it comes to disability? And the notion of it, the term itself, is it going to change? Or are we going to be having different kinds of conversations about disability down the road?
I think increasingly we'll have conversations about cognitive differences and disabilities. You know, already many people who have been warehoused for centuries, are learning ways to communicate via computer, and, you know, we're discovering that, well, they don't speak. They're incredibly interesting and articulate and have much to offer. So I think we'll continue to explore cognitive disabilities and learn more about human potential.
Dr. Kim Nielsen is a professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo and the author of 4 books, including a pair on Helen Keller, and her latest book is A Disability History of the United States. Kim Nielsen, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you for letting me be on the show, Craig.
Absolutely. And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Remember, you can hear this program twice a day, live weekday mornings at 10, then rebroadcast weeknights at 8 on AM 580. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know. We stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back anytime to past programs. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with Jeff Bliskall, Consumer Reports senior editor, about how to avoid consumer fraud and other scams this holiday season. Then on Thursday, we will welcome your questions for Dr. Michael Novak from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services. We'll discuss hearing health, everything from hearing problems like dizziness, tinnitus, and related conditions to what you can do to best protect your hearing for the long haul. That's on Thursday's program. Then on Friday, we will welcome your year-end tax questions for a couple of accountants. John Breen and Marty Verdick will join us. That's on Friday. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.